Anthony, I'm just excited to be back. I'm really happy to be with you and taking a look into this amazing book that we call Hebrews. Mm. But it's not necessarily just for Hebrew people, is it?
Not at all. I think it's definitely a Christian book. It was rightly put in the canon. It did struggle for a while. Some people felt it wasn't appropriate, but it's a thoroughly Christian book. I'm always amused, Dan, because at the end he says something about, bear with this little exhortation. I've written you a little piece here. You know, put up with me. I've written very short, he said, shortly. It's a very profound book, you know. But I would recommend that our audience would read the whole thing at one setting. Mm. At least half the book.
Yeah.
Don't read one verse and put it down. Read the whole thing.
Really get the full sense of the context.
Oh, yes.
And this writer was amazing, wasn't he? Yeah.
Yes, I think the grasp of the faith, I mean, the striking thing is that he doesn't think it's all over till the kingdom. In other words, this idea of once saved, always saved, so-called, is not in this book. It's a book of if you hang in there, and please do, don't give up, don't fall away. It's not a universalist book, then, is it? He doesn't assume that everybody gets saved. It's exactly contrary to some of the popular theology we have. So it's a profound piece in every way.
So we're not really sure who our author was?
No, apparently not. Some people thought Priscilla, you know.
Yeah.
And what was it? There was another. Yeah. Various people. Barnabas, I think, others.
My King James, I think, ascribes it to the Apostle Paul.
Possible,
but here we are, and we don't know. But one thing we do know, it's an amazing, wonderful, beautiful,
it really is
extraordinary.
Absolutely, it calls us back to the original faith. I think, and it's rather simple, and yet it's also very profound. The style of the Greek is rather complicated compared with some other books.
So
this is an intellect, this guy, whoever wrote this.
But he really communicates well, though.
Oh, yes, tremendously. Yeah. Systematically. He builds it all, much of it, around Psalm 110, verse 1. The Lord said, to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool. That's his slogan, really.
This is what it's all about.
Yes. Isn't that a marvelous verse? Psalm 110, verse 1.
Absolutely wonderful. And all of the New Testament writers and teachers, obviously that was sort of like their flagship verse.
I like that.
That is wonderful.
It's kind of a mantra, really, because it summarizes God speaking to somebody who's not God. Adonai, there in the Hebrew, is not deity, but the exalted, supreme exalted Messiah. Sit at my right hand, which Jesus is now doing, the exalted Messiah, until the kingdom comes and I make all your enemies your footstool under your feet. That hasn't happened yet.
Wonderful. Yeah.
That's our hope.
It's kind of a sad to me today that I find not very many Christians who are familiar with Psalm 110 and 1, although it was the most popular of all the Psalms, I suppose, or all the passages in the New Testament.
It's actually cited or alluded to about 23 times. It should be an absolute John 3:16 for everybody, if only because it separates Yahweh, the one God of Israel, the one God of Jesus, from Adonai, my Lord Messiah.
Yes.
And they didn't think that second word was Adonai, God speaking to God, you see? So I think if the public would get hold of that first verse of Psalm 110, it would be a revolution for all of us.
And it would be a nice verse to have a good, clear understanding of as you begin to read what the writer of Hebrews is saying, or any of the New Testament writers.
Yes. Right. Don't you think often we're reading a whole lot of theology after 2,000 years? We're assuming so much now with these post-biblical creeds, and we're assuming that all these people were good Trinitarians talking about God being three in one. It just isn't
true. Isn't
it's a huge anachronism. It's like saying, what sort of software did Paul have in his computer? Well, actually, it didn't have a computer. Isn't that amazing?
Well, it's interesting. I think that psalm kind of sets standard, if you will, entrance into all the writings of the New Testament, including the writing here in Hebrews. And also we're going to find that the writer of Hebrews is going to touch on Psalm 110 and 4. I think that's that nice.
Marvelous.
This wonderful priesthood thing. That's wonderful.
Not a Levitical priest. A shock, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Some other source. I love 7:14 because 7:14 is also the Isaiah text about the virgin will conceive. And 2 Samuel 7:14, I'm going to have a son, God says. Here in 7:14 of Hebrews you have... Well, it's obvious, isn't it, that Jesus is descended from Judah? Isn't that brilliant?
I like that.
I wish we all understood that.
Straightforward.
Very straightforward. Mary had a baby. She was a descendant of David. God arranged for this miraculous conception. That's very easy. That's the reason he's the Son of God, Luke 1:35. If people just got hold of that, all of the denominational barriers would come tumbling down. We'd all unite around a few simple truths.
That would be wonderful. And the Christian faith, to me, would make so much more sense.
I think so.
Yeah, lovely.
Available to many more, who now find it very perplexing, figuring out some of these mysterious doctrines that came after the Bible time, yes.
Well, if you like, I'll do some reading, and we'll think our way through this a bit, and just see if we can understand what this writer is telling us. Mm-hmm. So here we go. In verse 1, then, he says from the very beginning, God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers in the prophets, in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. And he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. And, wow, maybe we need to just start with verse 1. This is amazing. All this wonderful stuff. So God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers in the prophets in many portions, in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son.
Yes.
And
isn't that clarifying?
That's amazing, isn't it?
Isn't it? Doesn't that suggest right away there wasn't a Son to speak through in the Old Testament? We can even render the Greek in verse 2. It's a little ambiguous, but it could be, and at the end of those days, at the end of that Old Testament period, he finally speaks in the Son, and that's the passage in the Gospels where Jesus laments this terrible tragedy that God sends the prophets and they kill them and beat them and banish them. Right. Finally, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll send my Son. And what do? They killed him. This is the story of the tragedy of the human race, isn't it?
Isn't that amazing? Well, and by that parable, too, you realize then that the Son doesn't come on the scene.
That's right.
Until after those who have gone before. So it's not the Son, then the prophets.
That's right.
It is the prophets, then the Son is sent.
That's right.
Then the Son comes on the scene. Then God speaks through his Son. Yes. But not before, isn't that
interesting? I think it's very interesting. I've got a little quote here from A.T. Hansen, who writes on Christology a lot. He says, in regard to this point that you're making about when the Son came, it is not even certain, speaking of the book of Hebrews, that the name Son is unhesitatingly, that's a nice British understatement, but we should just simply say it's quite clear that the name Son is not applied to any pre-existent state. Hebrews 1:2 could be, I would say, should be rendered, he has in these last days spoken to us in the mode of a Son, which would imply that the sonship only began at what he calls the incarnation, that's to say the birth in Mary. No. Isn't that fascinating?
Which is exactly what the scriptures say.
Harmonizes everything. Yeah. Mary had a baby 2,000 years ago. Yeah. That was the beginning of the Son.
Yeah. So this scripture is then telling us right from the very beginning something extraordinarily important about Jesus.
Yes,
this Son came into existence. Yes. He came into existence after the prophets. God spoke to the people through him after the prophets.
God's final word, ultimate word, in a Son. Mm. But before that, he spoke in various ways, through angels, through prophets.
That's right.
And then my last shot at getting the truth from God's point of view was to send, I'll send my uniquely begotten Son.
Wow, that's tremendous. So the writer's putting it all in perspective right from the very beginning. So if we can keep in mind what he has just said, then the balance of what he has to say through this first chapter and on will be in perspective. It'll be easier to understand.
Isn't it the principle we take the simple, straightforward verses firstly, and then we fit the more difficult ones into that, not the reverse method that is often used. So once we realize the Son wasn't there, I mean, if he was there, he was very silent, according to this text, right? The Son was there during that Old Testament period, where he's silent and unseen. Mm-hmm. He doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
He wasn't there, but you see, the awful thing, Dan, is that some have turned the Son into the Creator in Genesis.
On my land, yes.
Pushing God out of his unique position.
Yeah.
That's very dangerous.
Yeah, terrible, terrible circumstance. Yeah. But this writer's putting it in perspective from the very beginning.
Setting the stage, as you
said. I love that. So verse 2 again then, in these days, in these last days, has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. And he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Having become as much better than the angels, as he has inherited a more excellent name than they. Wow.
Marvelous.
Isn't that marvelous?
Yes. Yeah. He's inherited this, though. Yeah. I mean, if he were God from eternity, he's got nothing to inherit or to be promoted to.
That's right.
The whole point is lost if we start with him as being fully God and wind up with him being exalted. You can't be exalted from being fully God. It's just not clear at all. So I love this. I must say here in verse 3, I'm sure you've come across this in your reading, that this radiance of his glory language is what Jews said of wisdom. So people stumble at the second verse when they find that God made all things through, or the ages, actually, the aeonis, using the modern Greek pronunciation. He made the ages through the Son. It doesn't mean the Son made them himself. It means that God had Jesus in mind, and Jesus is what wisdom became. Not what God the Son became,
yes,
but what wisdom became. And I think people would understand that in the first century very well. So all the ages are made through him. One doesn't leap to the conclusion that he was the active agent in that first creation. Any Jew understood that God made everything through his word. That's what Psalm 33 says. And through wisdom and word. Much of this information is now available in good scholarly literature, but it hasn't permeated to the pew yet.
Into the populace. No. That's right.
But wonderful that God had this Son in mind from the beginning and sees him as the wisdom for the whole point of the universe. Then he comes on the scene. What wasn't on the scene in the Old Testament time.
No. So the Trinitarian model, as they approach these issues, simply doesn't work. No. It just doesn't fit with what the writer is saying and what he's saying. Yeah. The Trinitarian model has a God the Son, and they've got him as being the pre-existent God overall sort of thing. How then would he be an heir?
Exactly.
That just makes no sense.
No, it makes no sense.
Yeah. The writer here is not saying that. He is not at all already possessor of all things.
That's right.
If he's going to be the heir of all things.
It doesn't make sense. I think the whole point of the Bible is missed if we don't have a human Jesus modeling the Christian faith.
Well, yes, yes.
I mean, if he's really God, somebody said it's like putting a fully fledged, able-bodied concert pianist in competition with a marvelous group of children who have some handicap. It's not a fair comparison. Jesus has to be a human being struggling as we do, otherwise he's not a model of faith in any way. He's not the Christian exemplar if he's really fully God.
It doesn't work.
It spoils the story from the beginning and it muddles and confuses everything. Yeah.
It doesn't do me a lot of good as a human being to tell me that God resisted sin or God able to resist the devil and all that.
That's right.
But if you're telling me that the man, a true man, Jesus Christ, one of us, did these things,
so you're not
then
convinced,
it means a great deal.
You're not convinced by the argument which quickly says, well, the man part of him did this and the God part. And that really is a nightmare. Yeah. So one would ask one's friend, well, which titles in the New Testament refer to the man part as distinct from the God part, and then it gets extremely messy. And it's worth remembering that 1300 plus times the word God, Otheos, again I'm using the modern Greek pronunciation, Otheos refers to the Father, and twice for certain it refers to the Son. But that should make people pause and say, what's going on here? Why is the Father called God constantly and uniformly?
And the Son perhaps called God twice,
then
perhaps in a different sense. And I guess we're going to look into that in this very chapter. That's very, very interesting.
Yeah, there are a few other verses, our audience knows, that are debated for syntactical and grammatical reasons, but they're not certain. Yeah. And who wants to found one's creed on an ambiguous verse?
That's right, So I like this again at the end of the third verse. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. And there's that Psalm 110 we were talking about, isn't it?
Isn't that marvelous?
It's right up front.
That right hand is the signal we're talking about, Psalm 101. I think if we just promoted that one psalm, it would solve so many problems.
If everybody can get together on that one psalm.
We need a conference, a Psalm 101 conference and rally everybody from all over the world, say, let's look at the Hebrew here. Yahweh speaks to Adoni, right, the protocol title for my Lord the King. Mm-hmm. That's who he is, and nobody questions it in the New Testament. It's easy stuff.
Psalm 110:1 is fabulous.
Brilliant, yes.
And
brilliant,
obviously being alluded to here again.
Obviously.
Now, I like this, verse 4, having become as much better than the angels, as he has inherited a more excellent name than they. Wow, isn't that powerful? So we're talking about he became better than the angels.
That's right.
That's an amazing thing. And and he has inherited a more excellent name than they, which means he didn't already have that name. He has inherited it. That's God right. has given him a name, which is above
exactly.
every name.
So you're not getting the impression here that he is an angel or an archangel, are you?
Not an angel, not an archangel, and certainly not God Almighty.
No.
Because then who it is, if he himself is God Almighty, then why is he inheriting and who does he inherit from?
That's right.
It makes no sense at all.
It makes no sense.
Yeah.
And the one group, you know, says that this is really Michael. Jesus is Michael. And they say, well, he's an archangel, but not an angel. But an archangel is only a high-ranking angel, so you cannot avoid that.
Yeah.
There's also the good point in Daniel 10, that Michael is said to be one of the chief angels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, Jesus is not one of any group. It doesn't work.
Right.
And I found that people at the door try to convince me that Jesus is Michael are really, really perplexed by that verse in Daniel 10:13. So if we can get that verse into their thinking, I think we could revolutionize a lot of strange ideas about who Jesus is.
So what are we saying here already, just in his opening foray, if you will, the writer is telling us that God did not speak through his son in the beginning.
Yes.
That didn't happen.
Very
there
true.
Was no son to speak through,
that's
would you
right.
say.
That's right.
He spoke instead by his prophets to the people.
Yes.
Then at the end of all of that,
he
now has come. Mm-hmm. His son has been born, and he speaks through the son, and that's wonderful, and that's amazing. Mm-hmm. And he has appointed him, this son, now to be the heir of all things, which means that he didn't have all things, not
that's
at all.
Right.
The son is the heir
of
all things.
He had to win that position, didn't he, by his obedience, his suffering obedience.
I think
so. That later in the book.
Yeah.
Very human. Again, he's the model of what we should and can be if we get this right. You know, we can be in this direction at least, not sinless, of course. But he is a real model.
Yes.
He's the real hero and founder of the Christian faith.
A model for us as his people.
Yes.
And then he's a model of God too. The radiance of God shines through Jesus Christ.
Yes.
That's
that
wonderful.
His expression, God's speaking, God's expression, but not a pre-existing God the Son, which then makes two gods and makes the whole system so incomprehensible.
And so then in verse 3 again, he is the representation of God. He's the representation of God's nature. But the representation of a thing we know by definition is not the thing itself.
Right. Yes.
So,
it's a stamp.
You know,
it's a karaktir in Greek, means something stamped. So he's the image of God. Like the image on the coin, you know, bring me a coin. You got the image
whose
of Caesar.
Image is on
it's not exactly one-to-one with the real person.
Yeah.
No, that's beautiful. And that is so easy once we see this is wisdom language. Everything is made through wisdom. Wisdom, not through him, God the Son. There's a huge difference.
You know, we have the example sometimes, I think you look at it and you say, well, it's like Jesus is a photograph of God.
Yeah.
And in a sense, that may be true, but a photograph is, or a representation, or an image, is not the thing itself.
No.
If you wouldn't believe that, then I could say that I have a photograph of my wife.
Yes.
But it wouldn't be very wise to think that photograph is my wife.
Right.
It's not so. It is a representation of
that's
her.
Right.
And Jesus is an image, a representation of God.
And Adam was an image too.
No, that's right.
So I think that puts the image language in a very clear perspective.
Sure. If whatever is the image of a thing, by definition, is not the thing itself.
Man is in the image of God, 1 Corinthians 11. Adam was, mankind is in the image, but we're clearly not God.
Clearly not,
nor is the ultimate image of God God. He's the image of God.
Right.
I think J.T. Rollinson, my cousin, said something about God has given us Jesus, who is the closest thing to God in a 6-foot-high, possibly besandled Palestinian Jew that you can get.
Yeah.
But you can get the nearest thing, that
that's
the character and stamp of God's
character.
So we mustn't go the opposite direction and diminish him, when we're hearing his voice and seeing him, as he said, Tom, you're seeing and hearing God speaking through a son, as he just said.
Yeah. I love it. Then verse 4, I'm just summarizing what we've seen so far. But having become as much better than the angels, he himself then not an angel.
That's right.
And then as he has inherited a more excellent name than the angels inherited. So this this is all about a human being, isn't it?
Yes,
it's all about
that's
the true human Son of God.
Right. Would this be something like an excellent authority? I'm reminded of Matthew 28. Jesus the Son has been given now. Amazing. All authority under God in heaven and on earth. Name is a foggy word for us. We don't use it quite that way. Certainly nothing to do with pronouncing his name correctly in Hebrew.
Yeah.
As some Westerners hear that. No, he's been given this enormous position, but exalted to it then. Not owning it already because he is fully God from the start. That just turns the whole story
into nonsense. That makes no sense at all. It doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work.
Yeah. Verse 5, for two, now so he's going to give us an example of how Jesus excels the angels. Verse 5, for to which of the angels did he ever say, you are my son, today I have begotten you? Wow, that's powerful. So he's quoting, this is Psalm 2.
2, verse 7.
Verse 7.
Yeah.
And it is well understood that that's messianic, that it's a reference to God speaking to his son, Jesus.
Absolutely. Yeah, and this is a storm center, this word beget in Psalm 2.
Yeah.
Again, it's like Psalm 110:1 related to it. Because in Psalm 2 you have God putting his Messiah, he calls him his son, then he says, this is my Christ,
Christ.
I'm going to put him on Mount Zion. That's the kingdom that's going to come when Jesus comes back. So I think these verses contain the wealth of the whole biblical theology, don't they?
And again then it's clear that the son of Psalm 2 and 7 is a human being.
He's begotten.
Yeah, of course.
Which brought into existence, that's what that
means. And so we understand that when this is being said in Psalm 2 and 7, it is prophetic.
Absolutely.
And obviously not happening at that moment.
That's
he was
right.
not begotten at the time
that's
that
right.
that psalm was being written.
That's right.
But instead it was looking forward, actually centuries,
indeed,
to the time in which Jesus really would be brought into existence and be born.
And should we say that the word today is a time word, you know, because later on Origen and some of the church fathers had to evaporate this word. I mean, they had to cause it to disappear because it was embarrassing for a church that was teaching that he had no beginning, that he was eternally begotten.
Yes, yes.
He had, as one church father said, a beginningless beginning. See, that's when we really lost it. We went mad and used words in no reasonable sense. So this today is a temporal word. It's a time word. And beget means, you can look it up in any dictionary, means to become the father, to cause to come into existence. Yeah. Unfortunately, Dan, at Nicaea, they anathematized people who spoke the truth. They said, anybody who dares to say there was a time when the Son didn't exist. Anathema.
Isn't that terrible?
It's a terrible history of tragedy.
Complete travesty of the entire thing. It's amazing.
Well, yes, actually they maintained the word begetting, but they said it doesn't mean begetting.
It doesn't mean that at all, that's right.
They actually had to concede that he was begotten, because they said that. But then we'll tell you now that begetting doesn't mean to cause to come into existence. At which point, really, it's a foreign language, and people then shake their heads and say, well, I would like to believe in the Trinity, but it's not making any sense to me. Well, no, of course not, because it's using language in a way that you never used it. It's a foreign language.
So here we are. We're talking about this amazing man, the only begotten Son, Jesus.
That's right.
And what all God has done with him.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. God has done something that I would not have expected, I think, and that's what the writer's telling. God has taken this man, Jesus, and set him in his own right hand, a place of obvious, amazing honor, glory, and power.
Yes.
And actually in a place that excels that of the angels of heaven.
Isn't that marvelous?
That's amazing.
I think we're dealing with the whole fabric of what makes the universe tick here. So I find this so exciting. This goes beyond our politics, you know, and all our struggles daily in this society. And we're looking at the whole purpose of God, which is to exalt a human being, to say, look what I can do with a man that's obedient.
Yeah.
If you say, well, he's really an angel or God, you've destroyed the whole story.
You've destroyed the whole thing, yes. Continuing in verse 5 then, and again, I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me.
Wow.
Wow. I love this.
Yes.
Verse 6, and when he again brings the firstborn into the world, he says, and let all the angels of God worship him. Mm-hmm. So, again, isn't the writer bringing to bear the great station that God has given to Jesus, and that it exceeds or excels yeah. that of the angels, because the message is for the angels to worship him.
Exactly.
Showing his superior station.
I love the way he brings in a second Bible verse, and it's as though he says, I've got one proof text, which we read the one about begetting from Psalm 2. Now let me give you another Bible verse, and here's another one, 2 Samuel 7, I will be his father. That doesn't say, I am the father already of a pre-existing son.
Will be.
I will be. 7:14 yes. of 2 Samuel is also a brilliant text, and he uses that right. proof text.
Again, showing that God was not literally the father of exactly. a pre-existent son no, or something. That's very sense. Confusing.
That's
but
right.
he will be the father of this That's begotten right. son when he is born.
So a thousand years before Christ, in the time of David, the son is still future. I will be. I'm going to become the begetter father, originator of a son.
Beautiful. 2 Samuel 7:14.
7:14.
I love it.
And there's a translational difficulty in verse 6 when he again brings... I would prefer, and again, when he brings, he's probably right. It's a little ambiguous, but
yeah.
I think he's using three proof texts to make the same point. Right. So here's another verse.
Like,
I'll give you.
And again, let me give you another
yes,
one.
Yes, that's it.
yeah,
that is better, because when he brings him into the world, firstborn into the world, that fits nicely for his birth. We all come into the world. That means we're
Surely.
Born.
Sure.
Jesus came into the world.
Right.
God's firstborn sure. came into the world, was born. So we're back to the origin of
right.
Jesus.
Right. Wonderful. And as every man is
yes,
coming into the world,
that's right.
and we get that in
Most
John.
Important.
Yes.
So, very important.
Surely.
Yes.
So this is amazing to me. Mm. Obviously, the language we're reading here
yeah.
is not the language of a that you would write about a pre-existing God person.
No, no.
That isn't working out
no,
at all.
No.
You don't call any pre-existing God person an image of somebody
no, no.
else.
No.
You don't call a pre-existing God person
right.
a inheritor.
Right.
One who's an heir,
right?
Because he already has everything.
That's right.
And
yes.
this is not the language of a pre-existing God. It's not the language of a angel
That's
either, is it?
Not
In fact,
sure.
he's been quite clear to
yes.
the contrary.
He's working against those ideas, isn't he?
Yeah, he's
yes.
saying he doesn't say you know he's better than some of the other angels.
That's
he
right.
doesn't say he's
That's
better
right.
than some angels.
That's right.
He is better than
yes.
the angels.
Yes.
He's superior to
yes.
them. It's interesting that God would place a man in such a station, but that's
Passion.
What's amazing.
Yes.
That's the
yes.
amazing. And then the contrast seems clear to me, too,
yeah.
that when he brings him into the world, as we were saying,
mm-hmm.
and all men come into the world when we're born,
yes.
so to speak, not from some cosmic situation,
that's right.
but we are all born and
yes.
into creation
that's
and,
right.
and made.
That's right.
But when he brings him into the world, then he says, let the angels worship him.
Yes.
So, again... the superiority
it's
to all
wonderful.
In our Lord
yes.
Jesus. It's amazing.
Absolutely.
Wonderful.
And we should note that angels are invited to worship this Messiah.
Mm.
We must get this over. The public is misled when it says, when it's been taught, that to worship means that you are automatically God, if you're the object of worship. That's patently not true.
Not true at all.
Because
yes.
David is worshipped by the lady who came,
Surely.
Stepped off her donkey and worshipped him, and
yeah.
the lady became his wife. And so worship is a flexible, elastic term
mm-hmm.
in Hebrew and Greek thinking, but not in our Western English sometimes.
As someone has adapted, maybe it's a reasonable
mm-hmm.
way to look at it, but worship can be used in a secondary sense.
Certainly.
The primary sense being meaning to worship one as God.
Yes.
But then worship is given to those of great esteem,
mm-hmm.
high esteem,
mm-hmm.
the kings, the rulers, and certainly the Messiah of God.
Certainly.
There's not a problem here unless you begin to worship one of these others as though they were God.
Yeah. Then you've got two gods.
Now you have two gods. It's a terrible situation.
It's a terrible situation.
So when he carries on with this statement further then in verse 7 about the angels, and of the angels,
yeah.
we talk about them as a category.
By contrast, yes.
Of the angels, he says,
mm-hmm.
who makes his angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire.
Mm-hmm.
So that's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
That's really great about the angels.
Mm-hmm.
He makes them
mm-hmm.
These
mm-hmm.
ministering spirits. But of the Son, verse 8, he's going to say something even more extraordinary, isn't he?
Yes.
But of the Son, he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever,
mm-hmm.
and the righteous scepter is the scepter of his kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And but before we go on, then, what is he saying here? Mm-hmm. He's saying the angels. He said wonderful, exciting things about the angels and what he has made them. Mm-hmm. But what has he made his son?
Yes. There's a nice little quote from the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament on Psalm 45, and he's quoting, as you know, that Psalm 45, sure, where the Messiah, the Messianic figure, is addressed as God. Immediately in that context, we have, thy God has given you that position. In other words, that God has a God. Now, if you have a God, you are not God. That should be clear. So right. We're not talking about two gods here, but the TDNT, Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, Volume 3, page 96, says, Elohim, the word God there in Psalm 45 that our Hebrews writer is quoting, Elohim definitely refers to man, and to a man in this case, the king, not God. Mm-hmm. So that's clear. You've got only two occurrences for sure where Jesus is addressed as God, and clearly this one in Psalm 45, quoted in Hebrews 1, is a reference to a messianic sense for God, a second sense, remembering that Moses was told to go and be God.
In that sense, yes, of course.
Didn't mean he was the eternal God.
Of course. And then to try to turn that into saying, well, Jesus is God like God is God.
That's two gods.
And the writer of Hebrews would have been pulling his hair out about that time. He says, what are you talking about? Of course not.
That's right.
They understood the Psalms.
That's
they
right.
understood those writings
right.
In the Christian community in the first century. And they realized that when we're talking about Elohim, it could be used in reference to the one true God of heaven and earth,
absolutely,
but also used, in this case, of the,
of
Messiah.
The Messiah.
How wonderful.
Right.
Yeah,
even Judges,
exciting.
The psalm that Jesus loved, 82, Psalm 82, and he said, why are you accusing me of being something I'm not claiming to be? Right. Don't you remember the Judges could be called Elohim?
Of course.
Come on, let's get this
the
right.
Psalm 82, 6.
That's not difficult.
That's right. And
not difficult.
So the Messiah is called Elohim,
mm-hmm.
as Moses was,
yes.
And as were the judges in Israel,
right.
and probably others.
Right.
Then. So that's amazing stuff.
Yeah.
It's rather a rudimentary mistake,
yes.
Don't you think?
I do.
To try to turn the use of Elohim in that sense as though it was referring to God in God Almighty sense, in that eternal
that's
God
right.
sense. Verse 9. You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness above your companions. Isn't that beautiful?
Beautiful.
So again, this is the honor that God shows toward this Elohim,
mm-hmm.
toward this one who is the exalted Messiah, the exalted King.
And
it's wonderful.
As Jesus is God, then, therefore God, the ultimate God, who is also your, the Messiah's God.
Right.
That should surely call in question the idea that he is co-equal God.
Oh, my land.
He has a God. Even in Revelation, he still speaks of the Father as his God.
It looks to me like that, a person can't get out of Hebrews 1
mm-hmm.
without coming to a clear picture of Jesus
as
this exalted one, referred to as Elohim. Moses could be referred to as Elohim, then certainly the Messiah would be. But I don't think you get out of here without realizing that Jesus is being referred to as Elohim in a sense that is entirely different from what we mean when we're talking about God as Elohim, the God of heaven and earth.
And shouldn't the stats that we mentioned earlier point in that direction? If the Father is called God 1,300 times and the Messiah twice for certain, doesn't that suggest a huge imbalance if we say, well, they're both co-equally? Why aren't they called God all the time? Why aren't they
makes
just
no
around
sense.
Saying
yeah.
that Mary bore God and so on?
Yeah.
And God is walking on water and God is doing this and that. No, the Son of God is doing it. That's rather
that's right.
Yeah.
Verse 10. And you, Lord, in the beginning, laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the works of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. And they all will become old like a garment, and like a mantle you will roll them up. Like a garment they will also be changed, but you are the same, and your years will not come to an end. But to which of the angels has he ever said, sit at my right hand, until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet? Are they not all ministering spirits sent out to render service for the sake of those who will inherit salvation?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, this is amazing.
Isn't that great?
It's an amazing chapter. And then we have these often debated verses that and thoughts that he's bringing us out of the 102nd Psalm, I guess.
Right. People overlook the context here. Either side of this what you mentioned as a difficult quotation, we have the fact that he's talking about the kingdom, the future, the inheritance. It's all forward-looking. And in 2:5, which is part of the same context, God did not subject to angels the world to come, the oikoumene, the economy to come, society of the future, concerning which we are speaking. That should alert us to the fact this whole discussion in chapter 1 is about the great inheritance of the future. It's not talking about the Genesis creation.
Yes.
That's the key. But there's an additional difficulty here, which profs in classrooms love because it gives them something to tangle
something
with.
Something to talk about.
That is that this quotation here is from the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament, made in about 200 or 300 BC.
Right.
They kind of used that in the New Testament as their, quote, their NIV. You know, that was a standard translation.
Right.
People don't realize that. It's in the Septuagint. And if the audience can bear this, but it's like confusing the word shipping with shopping, slipping with slopping, or slapping. In Hebrew, you don't have vowel points. And in this particular case, it's entirely reasonable that you could read the consonants in two different ways.
There's You're saying in the ancient Hebrew.
Yeah, in the ancient Hebrew. So you had a choice. And there's a Hebrew word there towards the 23rd verse of Psalm 102, which, as you mentioned, is thoroughly messianic. People not yet born, the new creation, all thoroughly kingdom stuff.
Right.
So that's the context in the Old Testament.
Right.
And here in 2:5, we're talking about the economy to come, not the Genesis creation. In Psalm 102, you've got a completely different sense in the Greek version than you have in the Hebrew version.
Ah, okay.
This is not something the public can look at unless they can read the Septuagint. So it has to be explained. But there's a Hebrew word, ana, which means he answered him. If you change the pointing and put ina, it means he weakened me. There's simply, clearly a difference. And it's a reasonable difference. You had a right to say, well, I think the pointing is this. And somebody else said, no, I think the pointing is that we came up with two different things. It's the difference between shopping and shipping.
Yeah.
That's a perfectly reasonable mistake,
right.
You know, if you don't have vowels. So the Hebrews writer is reading the Septuagint, and in that verse, God answered the man praying. The rest of that psalm, the man was praying in great distress to the Father. Now suddenly, in the Greek version, which you don't have in the Hebrew at all, in that Hebrew version, you've got the man praying, saying, he, God, weakened me. That's quite reasonable. But in the Greek version, you have, he, God, answered the man praying. This is completely different. And then that God who answers the man praying says, you, Lord. God is calling somebody else Lord that isn't God. And he's describing then the foundation, the planting of new heaven and new earth. Could I just read this thing from Isaiah?
By all means.
I found this very, very helpful. In Isaiah 51:16, we have similar idea that God is using Jesus to found the new heaven and the new earth, the restored kingdom, the world to come about which we're speaking. And it's the verse which says that God, in Isaiah 51:16, has put into the mouth of an agent, clearly. He says, I've put my words in your mouth, and you're going to plant the new heavens and the earth. The commentator in the Word Biblical Commentary is brilliant. He says, this makes no sense at all if you're talking about the Genesis creation. So it's a very interesting little twist that is not easy for the public to get at unless they will look at the commentaries, and we've dealt with this in some of our books too. But it's all quite explicable once we see that the topic is not Genesis.
Right.
And then people say, well, why is it written in the past tense? You late. That's not a problem. All these prophecies are in the past tense. It says, you have conquered the world, and yet we don't yet see it.
That's right.
Past tense, but it hasn't happened.
That's right.
So you have to allow for that prophetic past factor also. Can I mention one other point, Dan? And that is that people will bring the verse in 11, where it says that they, the new heavens and new earth, will perish. How can that be? Well, actually, there are stages of renewal, because in Revelation 20, verse 11, it says, the earth and heaven fled away, in Revelation 20, verse 11. There's some sort of change there, and you know that the heavens and earth are new when Christ comes back. That's quite clear. But in Revelation 21, you have a further new heaven.
Indeed,
you have after the millennium. So we aren't finished with changing society.
This is a renewing process that we're
stages.
That God is working us through.
That's quite possible.
With Messiah.
Yes.
I love that.
And I love this verse. It's easy to remember. But Hebrews 9:11 says, we're not talking about the old creation. It's the new creation we're talking about. 9:11 of Hebrews. Easy to remember.
I love it. That's great. So it's a beautiful passage. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
A little perplexing in some of the textual issues.
Exactly.
But nevertheless, wonderful.
Yes.
And I like your thought that what we're talking about here, by context, mm-hmm. the writer is going to tell us,
yes.
is not the Genesis creation.
That's right.
But the world,
that's
the age
right.
that is to
critical.
Come, he says in 2 and 5.
That's right.
And I like that.
Yes. The other part of the context is Psalm 102,
yeah.
which is purely messianic. It's
yeah.
all about the future.
Surely.
So you've got context controlling this difficult right. verse on either side.
One thing I could be certain of, I would think yeah. in my mind, is mm-hmm. any understanding of that passage that creates
yes.
two gods, or
oh, yes.
in the sense of eternal God,
okay.
or two Yahwehs,
yes.
is absolutely
yes.
On the wrong track.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Prima facie.
Right. Should be outlawed on
because, that's right, because
yes.
we just know that that's
that
impossible
be.
Because we have literally hundreds, if
yes.
not thousands,
that's
of scriptures
right.
testifying against
that's
such
right.
a conclusion. And
yes.
yet some people reach that conclusion.
They do.
It's kind
the force of habit, a certain clinging to the way we've always heard it.
That's
you know,
right.
It sounds right. And that's true of all of us. We're all conservative deep down in that regard.
Yeah.
James Dunn, you know, the great writer on Christology in his latest book, did the early Christians worship Jesus. He says, you know, the Bible does not say, the New Testament does not say that Jesus is Yahweh. It doesn't say he is the God of Israel.
Of course.
Rather, he's the expression of that one God.
Surely. So in verse 13 then, this sort of encapsulates everything he's been saying.
Mm.
He says, but to which of the angels has he ever said?
Yes.
Sit at my right hand
yes.
until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet.
Mm-hmm.
That's back to our Psalm 110 and
isn't
1. That wonderful
brilliant.
And amazing
yeah.
overarching yeah. verse, would you say?
Absolutely.
And,
can you imagine a tradition, though, that is so ensconced in a certain group, which says, to which of the angels did God at any time ever say? Well, yeah, he did say that to an archangel Michael.
Well, wait a minute.
At this point, you see, we've lost the power of communication.
Yes, yes.
We've had to use a method of understanding words that is foreign to everybody
sure.
except the people in that tradition.
Right.
It's very divisive and
yeah.
very painful for all of us.
It seems to me that in each case where he refers to the angels in this chapter,
yeah.
he refers to them in mass.
Oh,
he
yeah.
refers to them as a category.
The whole point.
And he never distinguishes one of the angels versus others.
No.
That's something we would be doing in our own creative theology,
yes,
I suppose.
Creative, a kind word. Very
but
kind word.
But the writer
yeah.
Always refers to the angels yes. in this passage as a category.
That's
they
right.
are their total
right.
category. Whoever he's referring to yes. as being the hero of this
yeah.
chapter.
Yes.
Is not
it's
one
not
of that category.
No.
He is not
no.
one of those angels, though he's
that's
been
right.
contrasted with them.
Deliberately.
And
yes.
the whoever this this hero of the
yes.
chapter
yeah.
is,
yeah.
he is not God Almighty.
No.
Instead, he's
yeah.
an inheritor.
Yes.
He is an heir.
Yes.
He is one who is spoken through
yes.
by God Almighty.
That's right.
It's one through whom God planned, developed,
yes.
and has designed
yes.
and now creating the ages
yes.
because
of
him and through him. And this is one who is not God, not Yahweh himself,
yes.
but indeed to be contrasted with the angels
yes.
and all the other creation of God.
That statement of C.S. Lewis, that he's either mad, bad, or God, puts a false trichotomy.
Yes, yes, yes.
He's not God.
Yes.
He is the Messiah, but that was left out. You see,
yeah.
C.S. Lewis
didn't
say,
give us that option.
He didn't give
did
us
he?
That option, but that is the option. The whole New Testament
yeah.
says you are to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God.
Yes.
And that's clear. You found the church on that, Jesus
right.
said.
Right.
That's very clear.
Yeah. I love it. And this is obviously the option that
yes.
the writer of Hebrews is focused on.
I think so.
And wants his
yes.
readers.
And he's working
to,
at it. Isn't
yes, he is.
Obviously, they're up
Let
against some
wonderful.
Sort of opposition
yeah.
here.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yes, it is.
So then he says in verse 14, winding up again, are they not all ministering spirits
mm.
Sent out to render service
mm.
for the sake of those who will inherit salvation?
It's comforting, isn't it?
So it is. It's a
yes.
wonderful thing.
Wonderful.
It's a beautiful thing.
Not that we should be obsessed with angels
of course
great angels, but
mm.
It's nice to think there's an unseen world watching over those who are candidates for the kingdom of God.
Yeah, that's a great thing. Yeah. So he's not against angels.
No.
He's just saying, wow, as great as they are and as wonderful as they are, there are these ministering spirits and all of this beautiful. Yet there is one of us who has excelled the angels because God has exalted him to set him in his own right hand.
Who has the oil of gladness above his companions.
Yeah.
His colleagues, I like that. And we're coming to the chapter next. He says that he, as Messiah, is worshipping God along with his brethren.
I'm not ashamed
to call them brethren. Well, if he's God, are we really brothers of God? I think we're sons of God, but not brothers of God.
And if he's an angel, then that doesn't work. It doesn't make sense to me at all. The angels might be ashamed to call us brethren.
That's right. That could
but this too. One is not. He's really, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. Well, great. Oh, this is a great chapter. I love it. Wonderful stuff.
Yes.